Grateful member of Al-Anon.
Hi, King!
Not like I'm feeling any pressure to rock your world or anything. I'd like to thank Richard and the committee for inviting me to come. As he mentioned, he actually didn't mention my mom, but both of my parents have been involved in AA and Al-Anon for close to 40 years now. And they speak very fondly of Saskatchewan, and they've been to Saskatoon at some roundups, I believe, and they were so excited for me to come, and I was already excited, and then I really got excited because I know what great program there is up here. I love to share when it's a mostly Al-Anon audience, and to have it be mostly Al-Anon that are adult children is just, it's really, really, my peeps, you're all out. You know. So I'm very, very glad to be here. I come from a normal alcoholic family. I am the oldest. I'm such a stereotype that, you know, this all occurred in my childhood, as youthful as I look. My childhood occurred long before we really knew anything about alcoholism. Now, of course, there are many theories about it out there, but there are lots of cures, you know. My dad and I trade various email stories, or when we find something on the news about the new thing to allow alcoholics to have a drink or two, because we think it's hilarious. But I'm very stereotypical. I'm the oldest child of five in what my dad calls the CIA, Catholic Irish Alcoholic. I will talk a little bit about, I talk a little bit about the religion I grew up in, but please don't take it as bashing any particular religion, because I pretty much bash them all. No, sorry. Before I go on, my opinion is my opinion. I don't speak for anybody else but myself, and my family is very grateful for that. But I took away a lot around spirituality from the religion I grew up in that was sort of damaging, and it took me a long time in this program to come back and find my path spiritually, and I will talk about that a little bit. Pay attention to the time. So like I said, I'm the oldest of five. My father is the alcoholic. He was my first and most beloved alcoholic, but I will tell you that I have many, many alcoholics. You know, in the part of understanding ourselves where it says, so if you have a, you know, spouse, friend, relative, brother, sister, I have them all and then some. Both of my grandmothers died of this disease. One because when she was 43 years old, she fell drunk down a flight of stairs and broke her neck. And my other grandmother suicided because she could not drink anymore. So when I tell you that I know what it's like to come from an alcoholic family, I'm not kidding. This disease has damaged my family in ways that I can't even tell you. There are five children. The three middle ones are alcoholic. I have eight cousins. Five are alcoholic. And I have a stepdaughter, and I'm not quite sure how that happened, who's an alcoholic. Not even, you know, related to me. But we have my siblings, children are working on their disease, the next generation. You know, you cannot tell me that it is not a family disease in more ways than just we are affected by it. There are 10 years between myself and my youngest sister, so and then my brother and I are Irish twins. We're only 10 and a half months apart. Yeah, a lot of you are chuckling at that because. So I never remember a time when I was alone, when I was the only kid. And so, my dad, when I was a little kid, I don't remember much that his drinking was a problem. I'm sure my mother will tell you differently. But, you know, when you're a kid, all I knew was he knew how to have fun. He also was very unpredictable. And I think my own opinion is that growing up with that unpredictability is one of the most damaging things that can happen to a kid in an alcoholic family. Because my dad's very affectionate, But when he moved fast, you never knew if you were going to get smacked or smooched, you know. So we all kind of developed this little twitch thing, you know, when Dad would move, everybody go like that. Because you just never knew. It was so unpredictable. As I get older, I have to edit more because I have more things to tell you. But so I'm skimming. I'm editing while I go. So when I was about 9, we moved to Oceanside, California, which is the northern San Diego part of California. My dad was a teacher. Always good to know your teachers are so responsible. But he was a speech coach and speech teacher at the local high school. And he got a job. It was on the beach. We all loved it, you know, swam in the ocean every day. But that was when the drinking started to get really bad. And what had happened to me over the years, and I like to talk about this a little bit. When I look back, I can see how I developed the kind of survival skills that I had, that I needed. And I don't really blame my parents. You know, I'm a grown woman, and at some point in my life, the behaviors that I learned to help me cope didn't work for me anymore. But by the time I was grown up, I could hardly look back and say, okay, now I'm 40. Darn my parents. You know, you look what they're making me do. And so, you know, I had to really work on a lot of that. But I look back now and I see the way that I become and why. And what had happened is I became the good girl. I believe every family has one. And if you have a good girl in your family, or a good boy, because sometimes boys are pretty good too, but if you have the good child in your family, let me tell you about what that's like on the inside. So as I told you, the middle three kids are now sober alcoholics. I like to point that out. They're not still drinking, but they tended to, let's just say they tended to take the focus off me because they started early with the acting out kind of thing. My poor sister, the middle one, it's always the middle one, my dad always tells this story about when she was about 18 months old, he told her to go outside and play. And she said no, which you just didn't do. And he said, get outside and play. And she went backwards one step at a time, and her eyes never left his face the whole way out. And he turned to my mother and went, we're screwed. And that was pretty much the pattern from then on. And so, as we all know, the person causing the most trouble, generally the drinking alcoholic in the family, is the one that gets the attention. And those of us who kind of go along because we don't want to cause trouble, because we don't want to get in trouble, because we sort of grow to realize that, you know, better to stay under the radar, we get overlooked a little bit at what's happening to us. And what happened to me was I became whatever you wanted. I lived my life by the look in your eyes, especially the alcoholic. You know, okay, which way do I jump? Which way do I go? And so what happened to me was that I lost who I was, or I never developed who I was. I just did what you wanted. And consequently, I kept a lot of stuff inside, so I was sort of sneaky, you know. I developed an incredibly imaginative fantasy life. Oh, you know this joke I usually tell, and I'm not sure. Do you guys know what Bonanza was? The old show Bonanza? Oh, good. I didn't know if it was on TV up here or not. I mean, you're so far away in a whole other country. I grew up truly believing I was the only girl in the Cartwright family. I would go to bed at night, and of course, you know, on the Cartwright family, any girls got killed off by the end of the show. You know, anybody who was engaged to any of the guys. So, and it might be a generational thing here, too. I suddenly realized that's been an awful long time. I read constantly, and when I would read a book, I would be able to just let go. You know, I wouldn't even hear the chaos going on around me. And so everything was internalized. We had a lot of fun. My mom plays the piano, and everybody loves to sing. And so we had parties. so many parties that, as my dad says, the neighbors didn't even get television till he got sober. So entertained. He said they all had Venetian blind marks on their forehead from looking at the thing. So this is how I grew up. I was scared of the God of my church, and we kind of went through the ritual and the motions, and I never really internalized a higher power. When I went to high school, I joined the speech team because my dad was the coach, and it was one of the ways I thought I could, you know, be closer to him and curry favor. However, his drinking by then had gotten incredibly bad. He was abusive physically and emotionally. And during the last 3 years of his drinking was an absolute nightmare in our home. He didn't take it out a lot on me, except verbally, but my brother that's next to me really got it. You know, there's always kind of a scapegoat in the family, and he would really get it physically. But, you know, I wasn't nearly as mad at my dad as I was at my mom, because she was an alcoholic, you know. She, I knew there was something wrong with him or he wouldn't behave that way. But she didn't do anything about it. She didn't protect us. She didn't shut up when he was clearly asking for a fight. You know, she goaded him. She made excuses for him. I couldn't bring my friends over, you know. And I became more and more isolated. Plus, he was a teacher at my school. Who was I going to tell? You know, I had one friend. And turns out, she went to AA at 22. Can I pick him or what? At 9, we were friends at 9. She knew what was going on. So, anyway, our family was a mess. By then, my brother was well into drugs. We had added on to our house, and my sister was drinking by then, and I think the youngest brother who's sober, I'm not sure if he'd started by then. He was only about 10, but we're precocious and stuff in our family, so... But anyway, my grandmother had come to live with us, and she'd broken her hip and come to live with us, and so she couldn't drink. Well, she was drinking with my dad at the time. But anyway, we built on a big family room. I was 17, and I had a boyfriend by then. And so I'll let you guess the year. The family room had a green shag carpet and wood paneling, and my mother had painted our kitchen butterscotch and lime green. 1969. My poor brother was using acid and he could never get out of the kitchen. You know, where's David? I don't know, he's stuck in the kitchen. You know, poor guy. And my dad was drunk every night, and it was just a mess. So it was Christmas Eve. And we had gone for our annual drunk driving Christmas light tour. Do you all remember those? We had a 1952 Chevy station wagon that my dad, for some reason, had painted with house paint, dark green. Such an alcoholic car, you know, looking back on it. No seatbelts, of course, so we were all crammed, to the little kids in the back, and the three of us in the middle, and my dad careening wildly through the streets of Oceanside to look at the Christmas lights, paper boys leaping out of the way, hoping to not be crushed. We got home, and our tradition was we open our smallest present, and then everybody goes to bed, and then Santa would come and put together all the toys. Well, Santa passed out flat on his stomach on the green shag carpet. Just, and my mom said, damn it, he was supposed to help me put together Chris's drum set. Now, I like to point out here that anybody who would buy a 10-year-old a drum set in that house was crazier than anyone else in it. And we did not need the noise. Anyway, so I said, well, I'll help you put it together. So, now mind you, mom and I had not been getting along because I was really angry with her. So we're sitting and we're putting together the drum set and my dad's, you know, passed out on the floor. And she's screwing in the pedal to the bass drum, and her hand slipped and went boom. And my dad levitated about 4 inches off the floor as one whole person, and then went back down and didn't move. Well, we were frozen, you know, in horror because we didn't want to wake him up. Oh, shoot. About 5 minutes later, it happened again. Boom. And my dad, up, down. Well, then she started doing it on purpose. And we laughed so hard that we had to crawl away from each other and just into separate rooms. We were laughing so hard. And I can tell you, because you understand, it is truly one of the most treasured moments in my life that I have with my mom. Now, I told that story at a work party 1 year, and I think it's hilarious. And I'm watching their faces, and by the end, they're all going, "Oh my God, you poor thing." I said, "No, it's a good thing. It was a good story." Needless to say, I only share it in these rooms now. Because you're the only ones who knows what that's like. Anyway, shortly thereafter, my dad said one too many times, he used to say, "If I could just get rid of this chicken shit outfit, I'd be okay," meaning us. And when the next time he said it, Mom goes, "Can we help you pack?" And he moved out. And 10 days later, he got sober on January 13th of 1970, and he will celebrate 40 years in next January. My mom didn't come into Al-Anon until March, St. Patrick's Day, go figure. And my life completely turned around. My job had been to raise the two youngest kids. The next two, of course, didn't listen to a thing I said. They could care less what I said. But the youngest two were my kids. And as the family fell apart, my job became to, keep people on an even keel, to make sure I got straight A's because that might help him not drink, to never argue with anybody because that might make him drink, to make sure the little kid stayed out of his way because when he drank, he was really abusive. And my parents came into program. I graduated from high school in June. And they learned from their sponsors that part of recovery was to take their job back as parents. And my reaction to that was pretty much, "Well, I don't think so. Been doing a pretty decent job so far. I don't think so." They wanted me to come to Al-Anon, and I went because I was a good little girl. But the whole room was filled with old women, all of them younger than I am now. But there were no children. There were no adult children then. There was one Al-Anon meeting in North County, and they were all wives. There were no men in Al-Anon. They were all what I consider to be old women, sat around smoking, and I had nothing in common with them. And then when I heard the steps, I thought, well, what is this stuff? I'm not powerless. The only higher powers I had ever had in my life were my dad and the God of my childhood or my religion. And I thought, well, they've done a fine job so far. And I was not turning my life and my will over to anybody. And so I went about, maybe 10 meetings. And then I quit going. And what happened was when I realized that I was no longer the linchpin to this family, which is what I always considered myself, I didn't know who I was. If I wasn't that, then who was I? I had never developed the rest of me. And so, as many of us did, I turned to other people, particularly men, to find whatever it was I was missing. I was never enough. I was just never enough. My dad, when he talks, says if somebody had asked him why he drank, he would say for 8 minutes, about four or five drinks into his drinking, he would have 8 minutes where he was enough, where he was content, where he was enough. And then, of course, he never stayed there. He moved on to the next drink and it went away. And I remember the first time that he shared that, I thought to myself, I never got any 8 minutes. I've never had 8 minutes. Because I was always looking for it for somewhere else instead of inside. So After about a year of putting up with this silliness, I moved away to go to nursing school in San Francisco in 1972. Now, I am not an alcoholic, but it isn't because I didn't give it a good try. My family is vaguely ashamed of me for not being an alcoholic, and my father introduces me that way. This is my daughter who couldn't make it as an alcoholic. My brother one time said, "I don't understand. How is it that you're not an alcoholic?" And I said, "I don't know. I like my glass of wine or whatever, but then I don't like to throw up." And he looks at me and he said, "Well, you get past that." Like I was an underachiever. But let me tell you what happened because of that. I got hooked up with my first husband. I was very young. And I was in nursing school and I was working. And I was so needy that, he loved me and that was enough. Now, this was a very troubled man, but then I was a pretty troubled young woman. He drank. I mean, that kind of goes without saying. But he branched out into other things. He was into a lot of drugs. And I didn't really like drugs. I wasn't good at it. Now, I have to tell you first, when I moved away, I lived in a commune in the Santa Cruz Mountains. Oh, I loved the clothes, but I was not a good hippie. I had the perfect hair down in my butt, you know, and I loved the clothes, and the whole no bra thing was cool. You know, let's do that. But I spent my life trying to find privacy, and I moved in with 60 people. I liked to work. I went to school. I was a terrible drug user. It was just not a good fit all the way around. So my ex-husband and I moved in together, and he basically said, if you loved me, then you will use drugs with me. If you loved me, you will help me sell drugs. And I did all those things, and I'm not very proud of it, but it was so important to me to be loved. And so I compromised everything I knew to be right. Everything I knew to be right. The other part of it was, this was not an ambitious man. This was a man whose idea of looking for work was to read the want ads and waited for an ad that said, "Bob, come work for us." So when he started to sell drugs for a living, he was terrible at it. So I had to help. He had no organizational skills. I mean, it was really sad. And so I said, okay, we're losing money here. If this is what you're going to do, let's at least set it up so that we make some money. I still laugh when I think about it. My parents, well, I guess they do now, no, don't they, because I'm recorded. Hi, Mom. Hi, Pat. No, they know. it was terrible. It was terrible. And when I finished nursing school, we moved back to the San Diego area, and I got a job as a psychiatric nurse, trained from the cradle. So one thing I didn't mention that I always like to talk about, when my sister that's 3 years younger than I am is she's dynamite. She's always been lots of energy. She's a very talented singer, very coordinated, which Sherry and I earlier were discussing how we're not coordinated and how coming to accept that has caused a lot fewer injuries for us. We were talking about all the things. I flew off the back of a treadmill one time at the gym and landed on the floor and just kind of went, "Oh, whoops." All kinds of stuff around that. But anyway, when I was about 11 and she was about 8, we went to learn to tap dance, to dance. And my mother insists this is not how this happened, but I went about 5 times and the teacher said to my mom, "You're wasting your money. This one has a chance. This one, no." My mother says that's not true. And probably what happened was, as with everything, I quit trying because I couldn't do it right the first time. And you know how we are. What do you mean I'm not perfect the first time I try something? What's wrong with you? And so when we would have these parties, somewhere around midnight or 1 in the morning, one of the drunks would come in and get my sister up and roll up the carpet, and she would tap dance and sing to Georgie Girl. None of you probably remember that, but hey there, Georgie Girl. You know, tap, tap, tap. And I would lie in bed and I would cry because I couldn't do anything. You know, I had no talent at all. And so, except lying, I was pretty good at that. But so anyway, one night my mother came in and she heard me crying and she said, "What's wrong?" And I said, "I can't do anything. Jan sings, she dances, I can't do anything." And she rubbed my back and she said, "Oh, honey, you have hidden talents." I thought, "Oh, great." Pull out the bulldozer because they're down there deep. And I have to say this because sometimes I forget. Years later when I talked to my sister about that, she looked at me and she said, "You think I liked that? I'd be sound asleep and some drunk would come drag me out of bed and make me dance." So it's all perspective. It's all perspective. Anyway, so I went to work at the psych hospital and I loved it. I did. I loved it. I totally enjoyed it. I worked 10 years in psych, and I always worked really acute locked units. I believe now that I'm an adrenaline junkie. I didn't know that at the time, but I think through my childhood, with all the kind of stuff going on, I think my adrenal glands just sort of fire at will. You know, and all of a sudden I'm going. But anyway, we were working one night, and the police used to bring what we call 5150s, the involuntary admissions. They would bring them in and keep them overnight at our place, lock them up, and then they'd send them down to county. So they brought this guy in, handcuffed, and usually they'd walk him in the seclusion room and we'd restrain them. And they did. They took his cuffs off in the middle of the locked unit. And you know, the guy was on PCP, which if anybody does know this, they little bitty people never take PCP. They're always great, big, huge, no-neck monsters. And so this guy he was agitated. And he ripped the wooden dowel out of a closet, and he was holding everybody at bay with it. And it took me about a half an hour, but I talked that man down. And he agreed to go in the seclusion room and lie down, and I gave him some medication, and he was quiet. But it took a long time. And I went in the bathroom, and I was just drenched in sweat, and I was so tired, and I was splashing water in my face, and I looked in the mirror, and I thought, it's my hidden talent. Not always useful at parties. Sometimes. And it was the first time that I had even a tiny glimmer that I could be enough by myself. That there was something inside me that was enough. And it was only a glimmer and it was fleeting. So I was still married to my first husband. Yes, there are more to come. Actually, just one more. He had gotten, you know, really, really bad with the drugs, and I now had a support group that I had never had before. I had all these friends that I worked with in the nut house. We had a great time. We were all the same age. We really liked each other. And what finally happened was he was always invited to join us, but he never would. And what finally happened was I came at home after work one night. I worked swing shift, and he beat me up. And he had never done that before. He'd been emotionally abusive for a long time, but he beat me up. And I did not stay after that. I was grateful to have the support of my family. I had actually gone back to Al-Anon by then, but I was pretty much faking it, as I knew to do so well, because I could not work the first three steps. I could not work the first three steps. So I moved out, we got divorced. And he died at the age of 32, all by himself in a hotel in Nevada, of a cocaine-induced heart attack. And it's very sad. So anyway, I moved back to the San Francisco Bay Area and met my second husband. I quit going to Al-Anon up there because they didn't do it right. One of the gifts of being able to come and share at places like this is that I have really learned how Al-Anon is everywhere around the United States and Canada. And it's such a gift to just accept it for how it is and all the parts. Isn't that right, Sherry? You know, it's just, you know, I come in and I get to share with all of you and I get to take a little bit of it back, and it's fabulous in that way. So I moved back to San Francisco, and I met my second husband. And he's not an alcoholic, I guess. I mean, I never thought of him as one. I don't like to label, so it didn't. His drinking didn't bother me. Let me put it that way. But I'm child free by choice, and he has two daughters. So they were 3 and 7. We got together, and I can tell you now that even though we had a 15-year marriage, that had I really been who I am now, it would have never happened, because it was, again, being really motivated by need. By then, you know, I'm a successful woman. I'm working. I have friends. I had enough Al-Anon to have a little bit of an idea of a different path, but I just couldn't do it. Anyway, we got married, and I became a stepmother, which, as far as I'm concerned, is the hardest job in the entire world, because of, well, lots of things. But, you know, you're neither parent nor friend nor whatever in finding a place. And I became aware that the two of them, my husband and his ex-wife, or as I call her, our ex-wife, that's how enmeshed I got, our ex-wife, did not get along. And so they obviously needed a mediator. Obviously needed someone to help them translate what they were saying to each other. And consequently, we used to laugh because I worked at the psych hospital and she worked at the honor farm. So on Fridays, the kids would get dropped off at the psych hospital, and then Sundays they'd get picked up at the honor farm. I was like, is this kind of childhood anybody should have? And they were, like I said, 3 and 7 when we got married. And it was very difficult. I love those kids, but it was really hard to stay out of the middle. And I didn't. I got very enmeshed. I got very involved. And as a consequence, I kept them from ever communicating. Eventually, we moved back down to San Diego. My whole family is there. My parents were getting older. My dad had a heart attack and then bypass surgery, and I really needed to be down there. And I also had decided that I needed to move out of psychiatric nursing. The laws in the state had changed, and I was getting older, and, you know, it can be a very physical, unfortunately, a very physical activity or job. And I became a public health nurse, which I do to this day, so over 20 years, and I love my job. I love my job. That being said, I'm not crazy about the H1N1 right now. We are in total chaos down there. I've been on the phone with my job, and anyway, I'm just laughing because it's like, you know, all of a sudden we're suspending every other thing we do so we can give vaccines. Like, yeah, what about our regular people? But so it's a little bit of a challenge right now. But I love my job. Anyway, I'm going to fast forward a little. I came back to Al-Anon, and I will, in January, have 22 consecutive years. I was a slipper, so, you know, in and out. But what happened was we had to change the visitation because the kids, you know, they live far away. And so we had a bunch of stuff happened around that where she didn't put him on the plane, we'd be at the airport. It was a big mess. And I got off the phone with her one time, and I got in the shower, and I was, you know how you talk to yourself, and she's not going to get away with this. And all of a sudden I had a pain in my head, and I had to grab the sides of the shower, and I thought, I'm going to have a stroke, and she's not going to care at all. And I went that night to an Al-Anon meeting because, and I, you know, frankly, I don't really like to give her credit, but she brought me back to Al-Anon. And I was really able to hear the message. Now, I've had the same sponsor every time I've come in. Well, no, not the first time because she wasn't in yet. And the first time I ever did a fifth step back when I was in the around the first time or the second time, I did it like confession, you know, Well, let's see, I lied to my sister 4 times. You know, I did this, I did that. It was about as superficial as you get. And she just patted me and said, we'll work on that, honey. Because I could never, ever do the God thing. I could not do the God thing. And I was sitting in a meeting thinking, well, what the heck am I going to do about this? You know, all these people believe in a higher power, and obviously one has to do that to stay here. And I heard the words, and frankly, I don't know why they didn't put them in sooner, as you understand him. And I thought, oh, well, I can do what I want then with that. And I did. And for a long time, my higher power was the group. I believe that I could not by myself continue to make the same decisions I had been making. And so I believe that the group could. That worked for me for a long time. And if you're new here or nearly new and you are struggling with this whole thing, it's okay. It's all right. Don't struggle. It'll come to you. I never got the big flash of lightning or the burning bush or whatever the heck is supposed to happen. It was really gradual until I realized one day that I had pretty much let go and given things up for the whole day to whomever or whatever. And my higher power now is a very different entity than before. And I'm grateful for that. The other thing I'm grateful for is that I don't have to compete with you guys for higher powers. You can believe what you want to believe, and that's fabulous, because there's no place here for telling somebody else what their higher power is, and I love that. And so I was in Al-Anon, 6 years, and thought I was really moving along, and, you know, I got it down, and I worked my steps, and I'm serene, and life is wonderful. And God went, ha, 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 fat chance. And time for another growth experience. And my husband, who had always been a wonderful provider, worked hard, good guy, got an obsession. And it wasn't a substance, it was a thing. And he decided he had to have his own business. He was a machinist. And he didn't want to work for anybody anymore. He didn't work and play well with others. And he decided he had to buy his own machine and have a shop. Well, we didn't have any money. I mean, we were working and stuff. So he starts doing all this stuff, and I kept saying, well, okay, you can do that part, but then you still have to work, or you have to get unemployment. And we always had separate money because the disaster was so big in the first marriage. You know, we always had separate money, and he would just give me money every month for the mortgage and all that. Well, as that was going up, we got a phone call. My oldest daughter had graduated high school. We got a phone call that the youngest was not in school because her mother had been arrested for manufacturing methamphetamine, had been put in the same honor farm she used to work in, and had escaped. So here's my 14-year-old who was already drinking. We didn't know that then. She started drinking at 11. So we go up and get her, get a court order, bring her back down, and she was not happy. And thus commenced the next growth experience of the next 2 years, in which I found more spirituality than I really, frankly, ever hoped to have. It was like, I know way too much about it. And here's where I'm going to talk about what it's like to be on the other side of we're adult children of alcoholics. To have a child that's an alcoholic is truly, I think, the most painful thing in the world. Because we learn in Al-Anon that we can't control the disease, we can't stop the disease. And I worked through all that with my brother, who frankly I thought was going to die. He has 8 years sobriety now, but we really thought he was going to die. Very successful in his business, but just drank and drank and drank. With my dad, with my loved ones, it's different when it's your kid because you're supposed to protect them. That's your job. You are supposed to take care of them. And when we had this 14-year-old who just did what she wanted to do, and you know, it was really hard. It was really hard. And what I did was I reworked my steps. I reworked my fourth and fifth. every single day I got on my knees and I did my third step. Sometimes I read the third step prayer from the big book. You know, I did what I had to do. I talked to my sponsor, trying to figure out where my place was. This was not going to be the same as when I got in the middle with the ex, with our ex-wife. This kid, and I don't want to dwell too much on what she did, although some of it was so funny. You got to find humor where you can. My ex one night said, "Oh, I hope it's a marijuana day. I feel like brownies." Or chocolate chip cookies, because she always baked, you know, when she smoked pot. And she would always tell us if we asked her what she took. And then one time I said, "You know, honey, I always know when you're loaded." She goes, "You do?" And I said, "You're trying to fool the wrong generation." You know, I just don't always say anything. But we went through quite a time. She had dyed her hair every color there was, and then she shaved it off. And that was entertaining. And I can't really tell you what I said. But my ex said, "I wouldn't care if she could sing." So we tried to keep some, you know who I mean, what's her name? Thank you, Sinead O'Connor, who was big at the time. And, you know, that was all kind of stuff that, you know, that was harmless in its way. What wasn't harmless was the fact that she started dealing drugs out of the house. She started, we started getting phone calls through the whole night from people that she owed money to. It was a nightmare. You know, it was a nightmare. And she would run away, and we'd find her 5 days later in some, you know, slum up in Santa Monica or something. Scary, scary stuff. She's a little bitty thing. She actually looked really cute with her head shaved. My mother, for Christmas, bought her those little bows you put on bald baby girls. You know? She didn't think it was funny. We thought it was a riot. I was always sticking them on her head when she wasn't looking. But I watched my, you know, our beautiful girl just really, really damaging herself in many ways. And then meanwhile, of course, here's typical. I'm working full-time. I'm in graduate school full-time. I'm the district representative for Al-Anon, and I'm president of the Homeowners Association, all at the same time. My sponsor said, "You can't even have a cup of coffee till you ask my permission." And so I realize now that what had happened in terms of my husband is he finally came to me one day and he said, "I can't pay my half of the bills." And I said, "Why?" And he said, "Well, because I maxed out my credit cards." And I said, "What has that got to do with anything?" And what it turned out had happened was, because I wasn't part of the money, he had been essentially charging his Visa with his MasterCard, and he was $85,000 in credit card debt. Plus he owed money for the machine, plus the business wasn't going well. Here we were, and all of a sudden we had to declare bankruptcy, and I had always had really good credit and, you know, taking care of things, but I could not pay that debt. I mean, they didn't care that I didn't know about it. We were married. So, and then I have this kid running around. And an incident one day, we had this black Labrador retriever named Angel that my ex bought for my daughter to give her something to love and teach her to grow up. That lasted 10 days, and then it was all our responsibility, you know. It's like, yeah, 14-year-old alcoholic, you thought she'd take care of the dog? You know, who's in denial? He'd drag her to NA meetings, and she'd go with a T-shirt that had a marijuana leaf on the back. You know, it was not good. We had the work Christmas party at my house, and she came in. She was nothing but pupils and a little bald head, you know, nothing but pupils, and they sent her back to her room, and they said, "I think your daughter might be on something." "Oh, you think?" Anyway, that it was just that, you know, I'd come around the corner and my stomach would hurt because I didn't know what I was going to find. So one day I'm home, I had this really cowardly dog. She barked a lot, but she was scared of everything. So she starts barking at the front door, and I open it, and I had a hold of her collar, and there's this huge guy standing there. "Teresa Holm?" "No." He was like 30. And he said, "She owes me $15,000. You know, I'm looking at... Now, the dog is barking like hell trying to run. And I have a hold of her collar, and I'm going, I'll let her loose, I'll let her loose. And my hidden talents, you forgot. Anyway, that was the end of it for me. I just said, and worked with my sponsor and said, she cannot stay here anymore, it's dangerous for us. And so she went to an aunt on his side of the family, stayed about 3 months, and then was on the streets for the next 2 years, basically. And she is sober today, and she's taking her nursing boards at the end of this month.
Wow.
Yeah, pretty proud. I went to talk to my mom about the situation with my husband and the money and all that. And let me tell you, in addition to all this that had happened, it was his attitude and his... The obsession had ruled everything out. You know, he would say to me early on, you know, I need this machine, and I'd say, but we don't have the money. Well, if you loved me, you know, we would do this. You would do this for me. You would support me in what I want. And I said to my mom, I don't understand how I got here. I don't understand how I ended up compromising again. My integrity, you know, I've been in Al-Anon long enough to not have this happen. And my mom said, honey, when you put a frog in boiling water, it will jump out to save itself. If you put a frog in tepid water and slowly turn up the heat, it will die. And so, to me, that's a really great metaphor about how when we aren't sure of our own principles and our own values, that we little by little by little compromise ourselves for somebody else or something else that is outside of ourselves, that we don't look inside and say, wait a minute, what are my core values here? What is it that I believe is best for me? What is best for my family? You know, one of the things that I love is the steps. We have the steps because we're all alike. You know, we're all here for the same reason. But we have the traditions because we're all different. And I love to apply the traditions to my personal life and my family life. We are self-supporting. The common good comes first. Our common welfare comes first for the, you know, greatest growth for all of us. It's over and over again, you know, and I actually today I apply it to my work. I manage the health center now and I think, okay, this individual wants this, but what is best for the whole health center? It's the only way that I think we can keep ourselves looking forward like that. So I made that, but, and my ex-husband, he just, I said to him, this is hurting me. This is hurting our family. And he just would say, but I have to do this. You know, I don't mean to hurt you. And you don't understand. And I finally was sitting by myself one night crying and trying to figure out what to do. And I thought, you know, I could not possibly be lonelier by myself than I am in this marriage. And that was when I made the decision to leave. I had no more respect for him. To this day, he does not, well, I don't talk to him, but the last time I talked to him, he does not understand his part in what happened. And that, to me, was the most hurtful, that someone who said he loved me and for 15 years and was my partner for 15 years could be so clueless and so emotionally obsessed. And, of course, that's what obsession is about. For all of us, whether we're obsessed with a person or whether we're obsessed with a substance, it leaves no room for intimacy. It leaves no room for the other people in our lives. And thank God we have this place to come to learn how to do that differently. Because I realize now growing up that that's what I never had was the intimacy because I was so afraid. Every single decision in my life until I found my higher power was made based on fear. I would get angry. I was always so angry at everybody. You did not want to piss me off on the road, I'll tell you. You know, in any way. And, you know, one of the good things about being articulate is that I can get up here and share with all of you. One of the bad things is I am sarcastic. And, you know, that's not a side of me I like very much. I can really be mean, and I work on that every single day. So I've been single now 13 years, I guess. I had a few dates here and there, but, you know, not. Now, I'm so used to living on my own, it's like, okay, let's go out, but you can't touch any of my stuff. You can't come stay in my house. You know, it's like, you've got your own house. I have my things the way I like them. And, you know, it's sort of funny because the person, I was always so afraid of being alone and never comfortable with myself, and now it's completely changed. I have had a lot of things happen in the last 13 years. I've had a lot of, some health problems, and in the last year I've taken charge of that, and it feels really good to have some charge of that. But I also, like I say, I do my footwork, but the rest is, you know, turning it over. I sponsor other women, and I love to sponsor. Keeps me fresh and reminding me that, number one, I don't have to go back there again. And number two, when the phone rings and I look at my caller ID and it's, you know, one of the whiny ones, and I think, oh, I'm so tired, and always by the end of the call, I've learned something. You know, just like when I come here, every time I share, I learn something different. I have a little aha moment. Grown in my work. I love my work. I have excellent relationships with my family. My middle sister has had breast cancer and has been left with some really long-term disabilities because of the chemotherapy she had to get. And that's been really hard to watch her go through that. You know, lots and lots of things. One of the things that happened after the divorce is that my stepchildren moved away emotionally. I tried really hard to keep up with them, and they just kind of moved away from us, from me emotionally, and so I hadn't really had much contact with them at all in the last 5 years. And in the last 2 months, I'm back in contact. They're thrilled to have me back in their lives. Found them on Facebook. We were talking about that earlier. And I'm actually going from here to, I have a conference in Sacramento where my oldest lives, and we're going to see each other, and I'm so grateful for that. That's been a big loss, and, you know, it's been really hard to not blame myself for that. I just have done the best I can with it. I'm going to read a little bit. We were talking about the promises, and I think I told you about how my mom tried to help me by telling me I had hidden talents. I've learned to develop all those talents over the years, and I've actually found some that I have that I never thought I did. We were talking earlier about the strategies of survival that we all learned. For those of you who have not read this book, you must read this book. I didn't read it for a long time, From Survival to Recovery, because I felt like I didn't want to blame my childhood for who I am today, and I realized after I read it that this book is not about that. This book is about learning, doing what we had to do to survive, and then when those tools didn't work for us anymore, finding our way in Al-Anon in recovery. All of the things that I thought were good things about me can be good things. I am responsible. I am articulate. I am positive. I am imaginative, all of those things. However, they did not serve me well as a grown-up. They served me great as a child for escape. But, you know, pretty soon I had to find another way. When I read this book and I got to the promises, I won't read the whole thing, but the paragraph that struck me was, our sight, once clouded and confused, will clear, and we will be able to perceive reality and recognize truth. Courage and fellowship will replace fear. We will be able to risk failure in order to develop new hidden talents. Now, my mom never heard that. My mom didn't even know what Al-Anon was when she said that to me. I still get goosebumps when I read that out loud. I believe that that was a higher power-inspired, loving thought on her part. That in her way, she wanted me to hear that I am enough. That me and my higher power, hand in hand, are enough. And I try to be grateful for that every single day. Two of the things I do every day is I get on my knees and do my third step prayer in the morning. And at night, I do a quick 10th step before I go to sleep, and then I do a gratitude list. Because I'm a great one for ticking mind syndrome. You know, I try to go to sleep at night and... And one of the ways that I've learned to deal with that is to do those two things. I read, I go to meetings, and I talk to my sponsor. And if you're in this room and you don't have a sponsor, I highly recommend that you get one, because our minds take us to very scary places. And I know for myself that when left alone with my own thoughts, I inevitably make a decision that's hurtful to myself or others. Inevitably. Because I go back to the fear, always. So, anyway, thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here, and I look forward to the rest of the weekend.